Hey everyone, it's Simi Shaw, and welcome to Trailblazers. Through this series, we bring you trailblazing by South Asians and for South Asians. We're the torchbearers, sharing the stories of the leaders and innovators lighting the way across the South Asian diaspora. Today on Trailblazers, I'm so excited to welcome Snigdha Sur. Snigdha is the founder and CEO of The Juggernaut, a new publication with original deep dive reporting on South Asians and South Asia. She previously spent time at McKinsey and as an independent media consultant for companies like BuzzFeed and Quartz based out of India. She also spent time in media investing and helped with the launch strategy for Reese Witherspoon's Hello Sunshine Media Company. She has close ties to Bollywood, having worked in film production with Phantom Films, which produced the Netflix hit Sacred Games. She's an alumna of Yale, Harvard Business School, and the esteemed Y Combinator. And unsurprisingly, she's also a Forbes 30 Under 30. As a woman trailblazing in the world of South Asian media, you can imagine I'm so excited to chat with Snigdha today, especially since I've been trying to get her on the podcast for the better part of a year. Welcome to Trailblazers, Snigdha.
Oh my goodness, Simi, you should just come around with me to introduce me everywhere.
I would be very thrilled and happy to do that. So excited to have you here, Snigdha. So for the uninitiated, can you tell us what The Juggernaut is in your own words?
Yes. So for me, The Juggernaut is a subscription media company and community for South Asian stories. And the way I think about this is, you know, I'm a consummate word nerd. We can go there in a second, but I used to do the spelling bee. I read a hell of a lot when I was a kid. I'm an only child. So one of the side effects is you don't really have like friends with you at home, if that makes sense. Like I didn't have siblings to annoy and my parents were pretty laissez-faire. And so I just spent a lot of my time at home in my room, in the living room, like wherever I could, just reading. Like I would be that kid who would, you know, go to a party or like a puja and show up with a book. And like people would be like, what is she doing here with a book? Like that was me. And so growing up, I just read a lot. And that's kind of how I learned about Americana. But I would also notice this disconnect between like what I'm reading and also the stories I heard at home. Because I'm also a huge Bollywood nerd. And I know so much random South Asian trivia, thanks to my parents. And I'd be like, well, why isn't this showing up? And as you know, like whenever like the New York Times or the Atlantic has like one article about the South Asian diaspora or one article about India, all the uncles and aunties share it everywhere. And like, look at us.
Yep.
Being represented. The thing is, I wanted that feeling every single day. I didn't want that feeling when Priya Krishna, who's wonderful and you've had on your podcast, writes one article on Yogurt Starter. I want that feeling every single day. And because Absolutely. Of the mandate of Mainstream News, as you know, which is to cover everything, right? They're covering Ghana, yep. They're covering India, they're covering every single thing happening. What surfaces to become news is just really short in terms of attention span, but also not often deep or nuanced because they're trying to expand the general audience. And so when I was envisioning The Juggernaut, my thought was, well, who are the people who are already initiated into South Asian culture, history, or politics? By the way, 10% of our subscribers are not of South Asian descent, which is kind of incredible.
Wow.
It's really people who appreciate the culture, who might have lived there, who might have partners there, who just are fascinated, right? You know, just as China rose, a lot of people were really fascinated with what's going on with Chinese history and politics. Similarly, there's plenty of people who are fascinated by South Asian culture, history, politics, quote unquote, big South Asian wedding or the big brown wedding. And so we were like, how do we tap into this community? They've already kind of bought in. So now how do we kind of go deeper? And I was so tired of reading like Bollywood articles that would start with Bollywood, the largest film industry by number. I'm like, we're over it. Like you can Google that. Like we're gonna just
we know that.
We know that. And so, you know, truly the mission of The Juggernaut is to be like the go-to source for both information, but also for just great exploration of a lot of these ideas that might have been like tinkling around in our head for a while, but no one's really pen to paper on. And we started as a free weekly newsletter, went to original reporting because we realized aggregating content wasn't enough for like, we need to report the stories we want to see. Our ambitions are, and you know, I'm going to announce it here, is like, we're aiming to launch a podcast this year. We're aiming to figure out how to do
exciting
video. We're aiming to figure out how to do even maybe film and TV deals, but we just want to multiple formats, but start with the concept of how do we deliver smart quality journalism on this community, on the issues that matter to us, because we haven't had it for so long.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you heard it here first. Podcasts and other formats are coming to The Juggernaut, which makes me super excited, obviously. So the one other thing I want to know besides what the Juggernaut is in your own words is the origin story of the name the Juggernaut. And I know it's on your website, but I want to hear it from you.
Yes. So, okay, going back to the word nerd land. So like any good founder, and so many founders write threads on this, right? This is like how we came up with the name. I think the first step was kind of writing a list of all the possible names ever. Our newsletter name was actually called Ink Mango. And that's what our actual corporation name is, actually Ink Mango Inc. to this day, as you know how it is. That was our initial name. But then when I was like testing it in the market, it just didn't have the gravitas I wanted. And many of the publications I looked up to, like the New York Times, like the Atlantic, the Wall Street Journal, they have a "the" in front of it. And I really wanted that. I wanted a "the" in front of our name. It's so silly. And so the and I started making up a list of all English words, words in the English dictionary that have South Asian roots. And Juggernaut was one of them. And then I took "the" plus that word and then checked on basically Namecheap to see if the domain was available. And so the Juggernaut was one available, which is crazy to me that nobody had bought it before. And I bought it.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how we ended up settling on the Juggernaut. And then as we kind of leaned into the name, it makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. So many people might not know the origin story of the word, but it was basically a British bastardization of Lord Juggernaut, very much revered in Orissa. Oh, wow. And the British dude, yeah. I like watched a procession happen and was like, wow, this is so large. There's so many people. It seems like everyone's, it's like a big ordeal. And he called it a juggernaut of an event, like kind of phrasing Juggernaut. And so I thought that was like a great personification of what we're doing, which is we're reclaiming kind of the British or the Western simplification and bastardization of South Asian stories and like how that ourselves.
That's amazing. And I am not surprised in the least that there's so much depth of meaning behind that, but also it's tied to a domain name being available because that is definitely how I've gone about naming things in my own life. So now we have that present day context. I want to take it back to your college years because for anyone that looks at it retrospectively, it almost looks like you were born to do this. You studied econ, you also studied South Asian studies, you spent some time in the media world. Is this a space you saw yourself having a future in back then?
Great question, Simi. So I would say that it's interesting to see this journey being not replicated, but seeing it kind of having parallels even to this day. But growing up, I'll start even before college for a hot second, which is, you know, growing up in New York City, I went to Stuyvesant High School, which many people are not familiar, has a very diverse population, but it's overwhelmingly has a very large and strong and amazing East Asian community. So growing up in New York in high school, because everyone is somehow an immigrant or has a cultural story in a weird way in high school, no one talks about their culture in school. It was so weird. It was like, when I think back on it, it's like, we never mentioned what we did on the weekends that were vaguely cultural. We were just like talking about math and science and stuff like that. And and so a lot of that part of my life was really hidden. And I think when we go to college, and I think, I don't know if this happened to you too, you start getting homesick and you're like, wait a second, I can't like not live without Bollywood movies. I can't not live without my mom's food. And so my journey was, I kind of took this class called Understanding Bollywood. And I was like, what is this class going to teach me? I know everything about Bollywood. Boy, was I wrong. Like this class, we had to watch like 2 to 3 Indian movies a week, which already meant like 6 hours.
Oh my gosh.
Right? And then we had to read 10 like scholarly articles on Bollywood. And it was so great because that was like the beginning of my journey and understanding how so much of what we're told is completely wrong. So for example, many people don't realize Bollywood is not like a bastardization of Hollywood. Like, oh, Hollywood existed. Now we're going to create our own version. Bollywood and Hollywood are basically like contemporaries. Hollywood was founded in 1911. Bollywood was founded in 1912. The reason we don't have many of these reels is because India had a very hot climate and many of these reels just melted away. Can you imagine? We don't have like 20 years of film history.
Wow.
People think that, oh, Bollywood started in the 1940s or 1930s. No, it freaking started in 1912. When I think about like the stories people tell me about like why Bollywood is less interesting, or this was around the Slumdog Millionaire days. They're like, Slumdog Millionaire is Bollywood. I'm like, actually, it's not. It's like directed by a British guy.
Oh my God, that hurts my heart.
Also, the story structure is not Bollywood. Another unique feature about Bollywood, which I could go on forever, I know this is not what the podcast is about, is that Bollywood follows kind of the epic structure, right? Which has multiple plot lines, multiple characters, not just one unique protagonist going through one journey. It's like multiple journeys happening, and some of them really isn't that. And so in college, I quickly realized that class was the window into me realizing I don't want to just be an economics major. I also want to be a South Asian studies major. And then I also realized, well, if I'm going to be a South Asian studies major, I better take advantage of this department. So I convinced Yale to give me like $10,000 to go report on Bollywood in Bombay, as every enterprising undergrad should do, get money from college. And I met a lot of people in the industry, and I asked some guy in my Hindi class, thank you, Colin, to introduce me to somebody at XL Entertainment. And that ended up me meeting a lot of people in the industry, interviewing them for a research project that became my senior thesis, and realizing when I came back was like, wow. And I started a South Asian Film Festival. And that was my first kind of entrepreneurship experience, I would say, where I started a South Asian Film Festival. Somehow suckered all my best friends to help me. My roommate was the graphic designer. My other best friend who was in the film department helped me like wheedle the film department into being a partner. My South Asian Studies department person ended up funding the film festival. And then I got like some of these like freshmen or sophomores who were like friends with me to like help me invite guests. Like literally just roped everybody in and did this film festival. And it was fantastic.
And is that when you brought Shah Rukh Khan campus?
Well, it was part of that in the sense that you are a founder too. And one of the things about hustling is, well, how do you think about being the most ambitious you can be? So if you're going to do a South Asian film festival, you got to have Shah Rukh Khan. And so as soon as I started the film festival, I was like plotting every single day, but how do I get Shah Rukh Khan to come? And we were really lucky in the sense that Isha Ambani was a year below me and she was in my Hindi class.
Wow.
And my specific residential college at Yale had a separate fellowship called the Chubb Fellowship. And what it allowed it to do was kind of invite more prestigious guests because they had like a more prestigious fellowship that they could grant them. And so I would petition the master of my college like every 3 months, like, Master T, how do we get like Shah Rukh Khan? Master T, how do we get Shah Rukh Khan? I wrote I wrote a proposal explaining why Shah Rukh Khan was the biggest deal ever and why he was bigger than like Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt and anybody else put together.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I gave that to my dean, I gave it to my head of college, and I would like badger them like every 3 months. Finally, I don't know what happened. Oh, I know what happened. The head of our college changed. We got a new master, Jeffrey Brenzel. And he came as the dean of admissions. He was like the former dean of admissions. And so he knew how important Shah Rukh Khan was. So like when I went to petition him, granted, this was like a 2 to 3 year journey. He's like, oh, this is a great idea. Can you like get Isha involved? I'm like, of course I can. So like,
oh my gosh.
Dean Brenzel, who was then the head of my college. And then eventually, like, let's be real, like Isha did all the hard work. I was a petitioner for like months. I invited him. And then I got to have dinner with him because I was the person who was really rallying to get him here too.
Wow. That's amazing. I feel like it's such a testament to the hustle you have now too. And with building the juggernaut, it's like really a foreshadowing I see there. At least I see that retrospectively. I don't know if you saw that in the moment.
Well, you know, I never thought I'd start like a media company.
Yeah.
But I've always, ever since college, I really realized that like what made me have so much joy, it's so important to think about, like even reflecting for you, like what gave you a lot of joy when you were younger. And I always realized it had to be around media, whether it was reading or consuming or creating. And it had to be in the world of business too, because like my head is like part creative, part business. And so I always realized I wanted to either be a senior person in a media company or start one if I couldn't find an opportunity. And I think that that's kind of, the seeds were definitely planted in college for sure in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually want to spend a second on that because I think it's super interesting. This whole idea of being a journalist, being someone that's deeply embedded in the media, but also being a business person at the same time. And I think in the last couple of years in media, we've started to see those roles coincide a lot more than they did previously. How have you thought about that and wearing both of those hats within the juggernaut and the work you're doing?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to see that historically, a lot of the kind of founders you've seen in the media world, whether it's Vice or BuzzFeed or even Vox, the founders were primarily journalists. And I would argue they were primarily journalists who were really good at marketing. And that is a business skill, by the way. So I'm not saying that they're not business people, but they still come from the world of like journalism and telling stories. And I think what's interesting now is that I'm not necessarily seeing more journalists or media people who come from the world of business necessarily, but I am seeing more and more recognition of they immediately need to hire a person who's like a right-hand person who could handle the revenue part. Like you saw that with Axios, like they came from Politico, but they immediately hired somebody who would be really focused on revenue. You saw that with Quartz. They hired Kevin Delaney from the Wall Street Journal to head editorial operations, but they hired a really, really famous publisher to help them with revenue when they launched. And I think that that's something that's been really smart, I think, I would also say I've also received a lot of pushback because even though I've been a trained journalist, and people don't realize this, by the way, I ran my high school paper. I used to write and report for the Yale Daily News. And I've been trained by like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, the Stuyvesant Spectator. We had a 10th period journalism class where New York Times writers and Wall Street Journal reporters would come in and teach us. So like I am trained. I just have never done it in a professional context.
You're trained.
I remember because, you know, South Asian women can never make anybody happy. I remember like when our assessment was announced, this ex-Wall Street Journal reporter like had this nasty Twitter thing about me. I don't want to name any names, but they were like, you know, Snigdha has all these things. She comes from McKinsey. She like has business experience. You know, one thing she doesn't have, she's never worked a day in journalism. And I'm like, well, dude, how do you know that? And I think that that's kind of to me that like, that is the reason that they think I'm going to fail. Well, you know what? I think there's a bunch of reasons startups fail and you never really know. But what I can say is when it comes to schools of experience, it's really important to have a head and like a foot in both thinking about the business model, thinking about the editorial. And it means that you have to make hard choices, right? Like we are a subscription and people have asked, "Why are you subscription? Why don't you make everything free?" I always tell people, well, you know, the other side is that we need to pay our journalists. We need to pay our illustrators. Over 90% of our journalists are people of color. Over 80% are women or identify as women or non-binary, which means that they're not sure when their next paycheck will come because many of them are freelancers. Yep. And so all of our subscription revenue and more, the reason we have VC funding is because journalism operations aren't sustainable yet. And so that means that all of our subscription revenue goes directly, and VC funding goes directly into our pockets of our journalists and illustrators and photographers. And people just can't compute that, you know? And I think that that's kind of hard. And I think when you make content free, as you know, like the original sin of the internet is to make content free. When you make it free, people don't realize that there's like somebody operating on the other side. What is the product when things are free? The product is usually an ad. It's usually something else. And so I know I like frayed a little bit from your original question, but you know, I think a lot of that, which is as a business person, like I think a lot about making sure I had a sustainable business model first. We actually hit essentially almost gross profitability last year already. So we know the unit.
Congrats.
Yeah. Thank you. We know the unit economics are great in the sense that like it's digital. We don't have a printing machine somewhere. Like there are a lot of choices we made. We've gotten customers being like, why don't you just do a Diwali edition printing situation? I'm like, I could, but then like, that means I have less money to give my journalists and my editors and things like that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of choices and hard choices we made. We haven't started a podcast yet because we're such a skeleton crew that we're like, we don't want to reduce the quality of our written word before we
other work.
So that's how I kind of think about it, which is like, I've had to make some tough decisions. Maybe journalists don't love it or other people don't love it, but we're trying to be on a path where we can keep growing and do it responsibly.
Yeah. No, I find that super interesting. And to be frank, that's how I got my current job. I came from finance and now work in a media startup. And I think part of the hiring decision was coming in with some business acumen. And I think it's becoming increasingly important for media companies in the business of evolving journalism to hire those sorts of people to make sure it's a sustainable business. So super, super interesting. I do want to track back to your journey to the juggernaut. You did all this cool stuff at Yale. You graduate, you go to work at McKinsey, and then you do the non-traditional thing by moving to India and becoming an independent media consultant. What compelled that decision to make that move?
It's so interesting because in the 2010s, I thought I was alone in this phenomenon from my scope of what I was seeing in terms of like all my McKinsey friends, they were going off to jobs in PE or startups in SF or other things. And I was the only one in my entire New York class, which was already this weirdly competitive class, who was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to go move to India.
Yeah.
And the reason I did that is that a lot of the jobs I was finding when I was interviewing, frankly, were not up my alley. You know, I was interviewing with media companies and they wanted me to do DCF analysis. Like I remember interviewing with HBO and they're like, great, you can do our DCF analysis to see whether like these movies are like really doing well or not. And I was like, look, I can totally do DCF analysis. By the way, I'm like the best DCF analysis person from my HBS class, I think. I'm just joking.
Oh my gosh. I love doing DCF.
This is like the accounting nerd in me. Like honestly, accounting is freaking amazing. And so I remember thinking, well, I don't really want to be an Excel person. Like that's not the role I have. And I could see my path if I
preaching to the choir.
Exactly. And so I was like, well, you know, how do I skip this? How do I skip this kind of phase that's expected of you as an ex-analyst? They think all you're good for is kind of mathematical modeling. And so I looked out into the universe and I was like, what if I moved to India for a year? Like, what would that be like? Like I have a lot of savings from McKinsey, not too much, but a little bit. And if I really, really hate it, I can like, this is the privilege we have, right? Like I can try to apply to business school or apply to a US job and come back. And so I went and didn't have a job, started interviewing in India. Nobody really wanted to pay me market, which sucked. But I was like, you know what? I'm just going to start consulting for you guys for free. And it allowed me to do some, again, this is very privileged to do that. And like at the Juggernaut, we really believe in paying everybody because not everyone can do this. I think I read scripts for Phantom Films. I then started consulting on a paid project with like Scroll India because they were about to launch. I think BuzzFeed New York found out about me. They're like, why is this like ex-McKinsey person chilling in India? And they like asked me to do a couple of consulting projects for them, BuzzFeed New York, while I was sitting in India, which was probably a great deal for them and great deal for me too. And then I even ended up doing venture capital because it was a great time because I met a lot of people. And one of my friends was like, you know, Singha, you'd be really great at venture capital. I'm like, why would I be great at venture capital? He's like, you like meet people really easily. He's like, you think from first principles. You'd be really easy to talk to and get along with. I was like, great. And so I did that for a summer internship too before I went to HBS. So it was a fantastic ride. And I used that summer internship, by the way, to meet every single media founder in Bombay and get to know them and understand.
That's amazing.
It was a great time. And I strongly suggest anybody that if they ever have the privilege of like, hey, I have a bit of savings, I call it like the inflection points of risk versus safety. I actually don't come from much wealth. I come from a very normal middle-class family. I am the black sheep in my family. People are confused in my family why I have even gone to Yale or HBS, truly. And so like, it looks like I come from a family of privilege. I really don't. I truly don't. And I remember thinking about this, that if you're ever at a point where like, hey, I have a little bit of savings that I've worked really hard and you want to try something completely new, figure out an experiment or something that you can run for yourself that allows you to do that, which is for me, I was like, I have enough savings for a year in India. Even if I get zero jobs, I'll be able to figure it out, or I'll do like consulting projects to figure it out. I knew there was like something called Hourly Nerd, which became something else. And I did it. And I had another moment like that later after I graduated from business school. But I valued those inflection points in life because I think sometimes people don't take enough risks because they don't think they can. But you really can if you just make it a smaller scope. I'll do this for a few months, or I'll do this for a few months and try something else.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that a ton. I think particularly like having gone to schools like Yale or Harvard, there's a certain risk aversion that develops because all your friends are doing the same type of thing in the exact same cities. Fortunately for me, I think being in the pandemic helped me subvert some of that in terms of leaving a traditional finance job to go work in media. But it's great to hear that from someone like you who's now a founder and like a seat that I would totally love to sit in one day, that some of those risks have informed future prospects that you've had and the work that you've been able to do to date.
Yeah, I think when you get used to taking some of those risks, like you have, hey, I'm going to like try another job, you kind of boil it down and it's called like imagining the worst. And you kind of scenario plan. And you're like, what is the worst that can happen? Like, you hate your job. You're like, I'll go find another one. Let's say I run out of money in India. I'll go try to find another job. Like, you know, like you just boil it down to the worst case scenario and you realize it's not that bad.
No, absolutely. So how did being in India, advising these media companies, inform the beginnings of the Juggernaut? When was the seed planted?
Yeah, I would say that when I was in India that summer, it in a weird way really reinforced, honestly, the kind of fragility of the ad model. So many of the Indian companies were just reliant on ads because there was this assumption, they're like, nobody in India will ever pay. And what ends up happening is that it kind of pushes certain types of content, right? Which is like, I hate using this phrase because that's not exactly right, which is like content that always has to be viral. If you think about Scoop Whoop or like the Viral Fever, which, you know, got, I don't know if they disbanded, but those were some of the companies I got to meet or companies like them I got to meet. And they had huge pressure to constantly, constantly, constantly be viral. And because that was the only way they could even imagine to get the scale they needed with the low CPMs to even recoup any money. And I think that that really stayed with me because it was a weird, like vicious cycle because they had to keep doing that. Investors kept on thinking of them as not viable businesses. And in a weird way, that's kind of why you're seeing even today, like media in India isn't doing that well. It's constantly getting money taken away from it. Whether it's because, you know, the governments are cutting off ad budgets or whether you know, people aren't used to subscribing. And again, like they're used to like viral content that's like not helpful. I really do see, hopefully knock on wood, it changing as more people realize really, truly the value of media. But I think that stayed with me a lot. And I will say the first version of the Juggernaut I had was like a Netflix for Bollywood. And I quickly did the game theory in my head and realized why that wouldn't work. I really thought Reed Hastings would be far faster and he would like acquire more Indian titles earlier than he did. I even emailed him once and he didn't email. I was like, Reed, you should hire me to run your India content strategy. And he responded. He's like, yeah, like, let's talk. And then it nothing happened after that. But that was like in 20.
That's amazing. That's awesome. I can't believe you just, that's,
you
know, awesome.
You got to shoot.
Yeah. Wow.
You got to shoot your shot. I really do think if you had somebody like me who is part of the diaspora, but also really knew South Asian content earlier. And he has great people now, by the way.
Yeah.
By the way, they're doing a great job. But like, I really sometimes wish if you had people like me earlier, they would have been a little bit further ahead in South Asia. But I would say that was my first idea. So when I was in India, I was really using my time there to understand how great media companies operate, what their business models are, what VCs find exciting. And I realized if I ever started a media company, I really didn't want to be reliant on ads. Like, yes, I can maybe turn on ads later, but I didn't want to be reliant on it. I just felt like it was not going to align. And so that would be probably my biggest takeaway.
Very cool. So then you've done this consulting work, you come back, you get your MBA. And I know at one point you started writing a newsletter for fun, and then someone turned around and was like, why don't you monetize this? Can you speak a little bit about that journey?
Yeah. So I come back, get my MBA. And the summer of 2016, when I was at Otter Media and helping my boss, who is now the CEO of Hello Sunshine, and helping her look at kind of media companies. And when I was like thinking through operations for Hello Sunshine, I got to look at a lot of benchmarks and a lot of case studies to be like, what's going on in the market? And that's kind of when I first thought of like, I truly, truly love this business. Black entertainment television sold for billions of dollars, $2.3 billion in 2001 and to Viacom. And it was targeting the Black community in the US. And it showed that targeting and being specific and being verticalized is actually a quite valuable feat, because you can be a ninja. While, you know, the New York Times covers all the world, you can really, really focus. And so that was a case study that stayed with me. And that same summer, my boss introduced me to a wonderful woman in LA. And we started talking about the original kind of some version of the juggernaut. And like, the juggernaut is a little bit different from what we talked about, but we were kind of envisioning more of a lifestyle business. And ultimately, I talked to her and she didn't want to jump because there were some reasons, and definitely all good reasons. And so I remember calling her during my second year at HBS, because I was like still thinking about the idea. I was like, hey, are you okay with me like just running with a different version of this idea that I've been thinking about for a while that isn't as focused on lifestyle, much more, a little bit more serious, a little bit more focused on politics, but also history and culture? And she's like, okay, cool, go for it. And I did. And as any true founder, I started by testing with a free weekly newsletter. I was like, let me try something free and like see what happens. And I was aggregating stuff that other people were writing. And then people would like, I went to my HBS reunion and people stopped me, like physically stopped me and was like, because I signed up all my friends, of course, forced them right from the beginning. And they would stop me and they'd be like, I don't know how you find time to write this free weekly newsletter, because this was after I graduated from HBS, but I love it. I've never seen anything like it. And remember, people weren't verticalizing by South Asia. Like, The Economist still doesn't have a South Asia section. It has a China section, but it doesn't have a South Asia section.
Wow.
So people weren't verticalizing by this. This was the first time we were doing it, right? And so they were just so excited, because it was like a little bit of home news, a little bit of diaspora news. It was everything. And then I kind of got tired of blurbing the same stories. So I was like, really? Do mainstream news not cover anything else? Pakistan is unfortunately reduced to about terrorism. India is usually about Modi or poverty. Bangladesh is about climate change or Sheikh Hasina. Like, I can tell you every single trope. The Maldives is usually about tourism. So is Bhutan. Sri Lanka about tourism. And so I was like, there really can't be more stories about these countries. And so that's when we pivoted during Y Combinator to original reporting. And we monetize only on the original reporting. To this day, we provide our free weekly newsletter for free. So if you want to check it out, go check it out, really. And I think people realize how much blood, sweat, and tears go into that. Because to this day, like, we're just still writing it. We're truly still writing it.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I'm going to put in another quick plug for that newsletter, because it's what I first subscribed to before I became a lifetime member of the Juggernaut. And it's absolutely phenomenal. But I also just want to say that I completely agree. What I do in my newsletter is a little bit of that similar aggregation and analysis. I include interview excerpts from these podcasts, of course, but even just offhand from personal experience, I've noticed in the last couple of years that coverage topics in the media as they pertain to South Asia have become a lot more diverse. There's a lot more sources for me to link out to, like the Juggernaut, because it finally exists. But I can definitely see how 5 years ago, that was not the case, and we were reduced to a lot of these tropes. So appreciate you mentioning that, and super, super interesting. You keep mentioning verticalization, so I want to spend a second on it. In 2021, we know niche media works. That's why I have a job. But that was not as well known in 2018. How did you figure that out? How did you know this would work within the South Asian market?
I mean, it goes back to math, right? And viewing yourself as like the power user. And so like, just thought about it and I was like, well, South Asians in America have $560 billion of disposable income. $560 billion. That's kind of like my TAM. And like, that's only in the US, by the way. We're not even talking about Canada and the UK. And we're grossly underserved. And so like, that's a problem though, right? Being early, right? The YC story is when Coinbase was raising, when it was like in 2012, people thought they were crazy. They didn't get any funding. When we graduated for YC, one of the few companies that had revenue, had real customers, and it was so hard for me to raise. Like, we can talk about bias and fundraising in a second, but like, I could also understand that they didn't believe in media. They hadn't seen it work because all their examples were BuzzFeed and Vice and stuff. And I was like, guys, like verticalized media, it works because it's like, it's kind of like a trip magazine, right? Like, think about it. Even if there are only, I'm going to make this up, 100,000 golfers in America, but there's one golfing magazine, all of those 100,000 are sure as hell, if they're like aficionados, are going to freaking subscribe to that magazine because that's the only option. That's how I viewed it. I was like, we can be winners take all. Like, we will be the best journalistic outlet on the South Asian diaspora and the global South Asian kind of population, and we're going to win. And it's going to be kind of a default after a while. Like, of course you're subscribed to that because your identity usually doesn't change. Yes, maybe your curiosity changes, but it usually doesn't. And so that was my hypothesis in terms of the numbers. And, you know, if you're often exactly on time, you're often too late, as they say in startup funding. So like, yeah, we were early. It was painful to raise our first few rounds. But like, now I think it's more and more obvious. It's great, but it's also, it means that we have to keep growing and proving it out.
I mean, I work at a startup that basically builds niche newsletters for audiences of executives. And I see that it's becoming way more of a thing. I mean, every day there's a new newsletter being launched on Substack about XYZ niche. But super, super fascinating. I do want to talk about your fundraising journey. I know you had this crazy turnaround with your Y Combinator application where you were like abroad and then they told you to interview. Can you speak a little bit about that and then some of your other fundraising rounds?
Yeah. So going back to like, when do you take risks? After graduating from business school, I ended up going back to McKinsey for a year. There were a couple of reasons for that. But while I was there, that's when I was kind of writing my own free newsletter on the weekends. And I kind of came to a point where I realized that I didn't see myself at McKinsey long term. And so I had about 5 months of savings in my bank account and I quit. And I said, if I can't make this a business in 5 months, whether getting revenue from customers or getting a venture capitalist to invest in me or getting any other form of funding, then I've gotten my answer that this isn't a viable business or that I'll do something else. And having a little bit of that mini time pressure was super, super helpful because I was so productive those 5 months. I like really tried hard to get more customers for my newsletter. I applied to Y Combinator late, actually, because a friend of mine recommended it. And I was like, wait a second, like, I'm going to just do it anyway. I ran a marathon during that time too. I was training for, I was like doing all these things. And the story that you're alluding to is that I applied late. I'm also a solo founder. I'm also a woman. I had no guarantee that I would ever even get an interview. So I wasn't even looking at my mail. And I was in a wedding in Spain. And then I checked my mail and I was the last person to open it. So there's only one interview slot left. And because the gods were somehow, maybe it all worked out in the end. So there's only one interview slot left. And it was literally the Monday after the wedding. And so I had to book a last minute flight from New York to SF. And I was in New York for like less than 6 hours. So I literally landed in New York from Spain, packed my bags from SF, had like a quick mini interview round with my partner who like helped quiz me, and then was on a plane again. It was like so fast. And then got there, did the interview. My first 10-minute interview was a maybe, which means I was like, okay, maybe I'm never going to get this. And then I had to do a second interview. And then after the second interview, I was like, oh, maybe I'm still not going to get this. Because they usually tell you by like 7 p.m. Pacific. And, you know, I was in Eastern time, so I was like falling asleep in bed. And then I get a call and it's like a New York number. And I'm like, okay, it's a New York number. So it's maybe somebody from New York calling me. But it was Jared Friedman, who's like an amazing investor and partner at Y Combinator, a New Yorker. And he called me and was like, hey, Snigdha, you're in. We're investing in you. And it was incredible because I had to stay the rest of the week in SF for some onboarding. And then I left SF on Friday, flew back to New York. And then that Sunday, I ran the New York City Marathon. So that was the crazy thing I did, which many people don't know the story. I've only told it, I think, a couple of times. It stays with you.
Yeah.
It was like, you can do anything if you can do that, right?
It sounds like probably one of the biggest weekends of your life. That's absolutely nuts, but I love it. It's just, again, like I said, a testament to the hustle. For those who don't know, Y Combinator is this acclaimed startup accelerator. They've incubated companies like Stripe, Airbnb, Coinbase, as you mentioned. Did being a part of Y Combinator start to ease your path to raising other rounds, or was it still pretty difficult to convey that demand to investors?
I would say Y Combinator definitely increases like your default state of being funded. By virtue of being at Y Combinator, it's already creating a demand for you because very few people get in. It's already been kind of pre-vetted. It's like having a lead investor of like a Sequoia or a Union Square Ventures. It's like, Oh, great. Like they've already been vetted by these other people. Like, that's great. I think that Y Combinator has been like, after now that I'm part of this crew, I kind of observe the Twitter chatter. I think a lot of people have become, what's it called, skeptical of Y Combinator because they've been increasing their class sizes. But you can also look at the secular macro trends, which is there are more startups than ever before because the cost to start up is so low. So like, I'm trying to be unbiased here, but as any true business person, I would definitely have experimented with class size because you're seeing a macro shift, if that makes sense. When we were there in 2015, we were a class size of 150 companies and we were considered really large. Now they're at over 300. And so, I mean, what I would say is yes, it definitely eases the path and your lingo to raise and you're exposed to the right people. And very, very few people don't take meetings with you. It's like, you're a Y company. I should at least see the company even before I say no. So it just really increases your lead, your funnel for sure. Now, what makes funding hard? Let's be real. We should talk about biases on this show, right? Here are the numbers.
Yeah.
You get less than 3% of VC funding. In 2020, VC funding women fell to an all-time low to what it was in 2017. Imagine that. It's been 3 years from 2017 to 2020 and the numbers fall. And let's also add this fact that it's easier to raise as a white woman than it is to raise as a woman of color. 0.0006%, I forget all the zeros because there's so many, of VC funding goes towards women of color. Think about that for a second, which is like, when we do think about, female founders, we often think of the usual suspects, right? Which is, I admire all of these people, by the way. We think of like the Bumble CEO. We think of these companies that we shouldn't be thinking like that. And I think that the world has a long way to go. And I'm so, so excited to see all these initiatives that are like, let's invest in more Black and Latino women founders. But I will always argue you should be investing in Asian women as well, because they're actually vastly underrepresented. It's like, let's be real. There's intersectionality here. I don't think we're trying to compete or say anybody is worse off. We're just trying to say like, there is intersectionality here. All women should be considered quote unquote as minorities when it comes to founding companies. And we should especially be paying attention to women of color when it comes to raising. And the reason this is really, really important, I want to highlight, is seed is where most of the biases come in. Seed is where you don't have numbers usually. It's all about potential. And people are judging you on a fake version of potential that they think that they're seeing in you. And if you don't look like their past patterns, they're not going to say yes. So I even had an investor tell me, I don't think you have what it takes to start this company. And I was like, can you please give me facts as to like why you think that? Like, you know what I mean? Like, and I'm 100% sure this person hadn't even seen my LinkedIn. So I sent him my LinkedIn and he's like, you know what? We'd like to invest, but we'd like to invest at like a 50% discount. I was like, you know what? I'm not doing that. I'm so sorry. Thank you so much. And like, even when they acknowledge my expertise, they want to get in at a cheaper price than the rest of my round, which was already more than half full. Those are the tiny microaggressions that happen that female founders face. And I could tell you a list that of things people tell me. And another thing that's really controversial, but I do want to say, is that female investors are also very, very, very likely to be susceptible to these biases too. So just having a female investor doesn't change it. Often they're under greater pressure to perform because sometimes they're one of the few female investors at a fund. Gets really competitive. They feel like they have
got a seat at the table
only at the hot deals. And then they're not even investing in women founders either. So like this weird proxy of if we have more female investors at our partnership, we'll have more female founders. No. That's not what's going to happen. You need to really, really, really be careful. You're getting that actual direct outcome, which is you're actually getting 50% female founders in your companies.
Absolutely. Really well said points around the state of fundraising and what it looks like. And the fact that it's gotten more sad over the past couple of years and definitely in the pandemic. I want to take another second on the point of representation, just given the work that you've been doing. I'm a huge fan of Namaste Club on Clubhouse, where I feel more seen than I have in a very long time. There's so many brown women that are taking over newsrooms. What is it like being a part of that movement?
Wow. I never really considered myself part of a movement, but I will say that thank you for saying all of those things. It's great to see so much, I will say, excellence and solidarity. And our mission has always been to highlight the whole spectrum of stories. And I always want to say here that, like, just to pause on a second, that diversity is just an ongoing mission that never truly ends. I'm never going to say we're perfect, but we will keep trying, and we will keep improving. And that means across so many dimensions when you're South Asian, right? It means across religion, it means across country of origin, sexual orientation, caste. It means so many, so many things, gender. And so when I think about what we're doing and what I'm seeing in the market, it's really exciting to see all these people taking on these positions in media companies. Again, going back to it, still doesn't mean we're going to see the outcomes we want. So like, it's still up to all of us to keep pushing for that diversity in whatever that company is doing ultimately. So is Teen Vogue going to be more diverse in terms of the writers they pull? And like, by the way, I'm not trying to say that they aren't diverse already. I'm just trying to say, what are the metrics that they're going to hold themselves accountable to? Because I think sometimes we as a community are also guilty of saying, yay, representation, and stopping there. If that makes sense. Like, yay, we have people in power, but sometimes that doesn't translate to anything really. And that's okay too. Like, everyone is on their own journey, but that's my kind of TLDR, which is I'm excited to see more and more people in power, but I'm also excited to see what they'll do with it. And I'm also excited to see how we can keep improving our diversity. So that's kind of what's top of mind for me.
Definitely. And I really appreciate the sentiment around continuing to push the mission of diversity forward. It's super important. In that vein, as we talk about diversity, it often relates to the content we're producing and the community and cultural niches we exist within. So, for instance, the South Asian diaspora in and of itself is very vast and very diverse. And sometimes I think we tend to undercut the difficulties of writing or producing content within a cultural niche because in and of itself, it encompasses so many different communities. And reporting on it from abroad has its own challenges. What is your process for grappling with that in the work you do and are doing with the Juggernaut?
Yes. And I think the first thing to just accept for us and the entire editorial team is that we'll never make everybody happy.
Yeah.
And once you accept that fact and move on, it allows you to kind of be a little bit more intentional in terms of our kind of portfolio. So for example, today we did a story on Tibet. And the reason we did a story in Tibet is because the Dalai Lama, when he fled Tibet, actually ended up in India. And so he's become this kind of spiritual and political figure across the world. But sometimes South Asians have this extra kind of attachment to this guy. Why? Because of this.
Yeah.
And so we reported on the next election. And one could argue, okay, no one's talking about it. Why are you reporting on this? And so it's always a fine balance of we have to report on what's current and what's news, but we also have to push the boundaries of what is considered news and what is considered interesting. And sometimes those articles won't get the most views or subscribers, but we're still pushing our editorial discipline forward. So I would say that's how we balance it, which is how do we get and capture the diversity of diaspora voices, but also how do we also push the boundaries of what the diaspora might be curious to know about? Like, I learned so much from this article as a diaspora kid. I was like, oh my God, I didn't know all this was happening in Tibet. And so I'd like to think that if people are looking to just get a little bit smarter about something, that they'll find that at the Juggernaut.
Yeah, that's great. I love the point on editorial merit because I think we're increasingly living in a world where things are commoditized more easily. And so it's a lot more about the dollars you're immediately earning or the ability for something to go viral or earn those advertising dollars. But I'd like to think the subscription model is helping that problem by making people value the product itself at hand, which in this case is news and information. So really appreciate that that's something that you consider with what you're building with the Juggernaut. I'm curious, you know, I've personally seen the Juggernaut catch a lot of flack from internet trolls, and maybe I'm biased, but it does seem excessive even compared to other publications I've seen. How have you dealt with that?
Oh, goodness. No, we can talk a little bit about mental health here, which is it seems like we do attract a lot of excessive trolling. And I think it comes from both the left and the right, which is kind of incredible. And so when I've spoken to my mentors in the industry, like I have to call out like Mitra Kalita and other folks who've just been along with the ride, they're like, you're doing something right then. You know, if both the left and the right hate you. We've been called both Hindu-phobic as well as, what's the other word for it? Islamophobic. We've been called both. Truly, truly. And we're like, we're doing the best we can. And if you really read our reporting, it is reporting. I think a lot of people forget what journalism is. Journalism isn't supposed to just tell you what an imagined future is. Unfortunately, or fortunately, journalism is also supposed to reflect back what the current reality is. So for example, when we're covering, I remember we posted a diaspora news I might get in hot water for saying this, but we have to cover diaspora news because that's part of our job. We're a news organization. So we posted a post that said, hey, in case you missed it, like Priyanka Chopra has been affiliated with a new New York restaurant that just opened. We got a lot of flack saying, oh, you're supporting her. You're supporting her politics. And I'm like, wait a second. We're the same exact publication that when she did do something problematic, we wrote an op-ed about it. About, I don't know if you remember the LA BeautyCon incident, but we published an op-ed about it. I'm like, we're that very same publication. We're not trying to like, anyway, we got that from the left. And I think from the right, we've gotten things like, why do you call it South Asia? Like, you should just call it India. And I'm like, well, the reason we call it South Asia is very, very specific. Like, you probably saw that too. I personally have had family that's grown up in Burma and Bangladesh. I am a partition family. So when I think about South Asia, I actually think about all of those countries because technically, absolutely, I don't even have an ancestor in India. I don't. I can't pinpoint it. If you can help me find it, please help me find it, Mr. India. But I can't. It's not in India. It's in South Asia. And so the reason we call it South Asia and it's become a more acceptable term is because it accounts for pre-partition lines. It accounts for the fact that it was a larger region that had a shared culture and history and past. And so we've gotten a lot of flack from the right for that. We've gotten a lot of flack for even saying something like Eid Mubarak. They're like, oh, why are you saying Eid Mubarak? And we're like, why? Why aren't we saying it? Because we are, because part of our population celebrates Eid. And that's why we say it. And so I really do think that if everybody could just take a step back and understand what the job of news is, it's supposed to reflect what's going on. It's supposed to talk about what's going on. It's also supposed to just mention things that are happening so that people are informed. It doesn't necessarily mean we're for or against anything. All we can do is our best to show both sides of the story, as well as show where things are mostly landing upon. So,
wow. Power to you for dealing with that and having such a clear mission behind the work you're doing. All this said, what is your vision for the future of the Juggernaut?
Yes, so much vision. Simi, like, we should definitely keep chatting in general. So nice to meet you. And, you know, our vision is truly to become, I would say, much better and much more spread out in terms of our formats. We now have a sense for what makes a great story. We know that as a team. We have a sense for what stories aren't being told. We've always told ourselves we want to tell untold stories with depth and nuance. And what's really next is how do we expand into other formats, whether it's podcasts, whether it's videos, even having more events. We stopped doing a lot of events. I don't know if you're based in New York right now, but we used to do all these sold out amazing events in New York pre-COVID. Post-COVID, we've switched to digital, but it just doesn't feel the same. And one of the special parts about being a Juggernaut subscriber is you can actually meet other Juggernaut subscribers. So, you know, we had all these huge plans in 2020. We were going to start ambassador cities. So we'd have an SF meetup. We'd have like LA meetups. It would have been so bomb. There's a lot in store. But in terms of what else is in store that I'm going to share with you is we have a redesign coming up with a very, very exciting firm, and we're getting our own fonts. So it's going to be all created by South Asian foundries, and it's going to look really, really good, and I'm really excited for it. I just saw a tweet the other day. It's like, you know, your startup isn't doing well if you're doing an unnecessary redesign. And I'm like, we're doing the redesign because we realize that a lot of our visual imagery has become too generic now because we use this font called Poppins and everybody has started using the internet in the past 2 years. Thank you so much. So we were like, well, how do we celebrate? And we chose Poppins because it was created by a South Asian font foundry. So we're like, how do we go back to our roots and pick fonts that are created by South Asians but aren't so ubiquitous that it's losing its cultural roots? That's coming up as well.
Well, that's super exciting. Congratulations. I cannot wait to see it. And I also want to say, I appreciate how thoughtful you are about something that wouldn't be top of mind for most people and definitely even users of the product. So I'm really looking forward to seeing it. And as I think about your leadership and management style, the last question I have for you is, what is one thing you wish you'd known before you became a founder?
It's really, and I know I knew this already, but just to double underline, it's really, 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 really all about the people. And when I say that, I mean, it's about the customers. It's about the team you hire. And if there's one thing I could have done differently, and I really told myself this, has been even more aggressive when it came to fundraising, been even more aggressive when it came to hiring. It's just so important to like learn how to, it's a phrase called let go of your Legos. And in a weird way, folks like us, Simi, like we're probably really good at a bunch of different things, right? We're like very much like, I guess, Jills of all trades or whatever you want to call it.
And yeah.
Exactly. It kind of makes us delay the obvious. If we were both really bad at everything and there was one great thing we were good at, we'd only do that one thing and we'd delegate everything else. Yep. But because we were good at multiple things, we end up taking on more than we should. and delay the delegation and delay the hiring. And so that's my number one lesson as a founder is even if you're great at a lot of things, which many founders are, that's how they became founders. Even if you're great at a lot of functions and that allows you to delay costs, have more cost savings and delay spend and all of that, don't fall into that temptation. As soon as you can, hire great people and really cultivate them and keep them and make them have even more responsibility. And the best startup joiners, they want more responsibility. That's another thing I've noticed. They're not going to be afraid of it. And so like, be okay to ask for more is what I would say in general all around as a founder, and be okay with asking your team for more as well. And you'll be surprised at how much they deliver and like really care. Yeah. And it's been really exciting, all the people I've gotten to meet just doing the juggernaut that I wouldn't have met otherwise. So yeah, it's all about the people.
Thanks for sharing that. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I'm not even sure we would have met if you hadn't been working on the juggernaut. So it's a point definitely well taken. And I can't even begin to tell you how much I personally needed to hear that with the variety of projects I've been working on, but it's really great advice. On that note, I want to say thank you so much, Snigdha, for coming on the podcast. This was such an incredible conversation. I continue to be so excited about what you're building with the juggernaut and can't wait to continue following your journey. So wishing you the best of luck with everything you have coming up. And thanks so much for coming on Trailblazers.
Thanks so much, Simi, for all that you do. So excited to be here. Sorry it took so long, but we're here. And it's Asian Pacific American Heritage Month. So my last call to action is go check out all those Asian American stories that you might have delayed reading. It's really, really important to know.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
This is a podcast from Trailblazers Media. For more content on South Asian trailblazing, follow us at South Asian Trailblazers on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you.